For you.
Good. Okay. This is, I'm Eleanor Swent, and we're continuing the interview with James Boyd in Carmel on November 1st in the afternoon. And we have, I think, more or less finished the Colorado School of Mines period, and now you've gone back to Washington again as director of the Bureau of Mines. And
did I cover the trip there and the
Centralia? Yes,
disaster.
You mentioned that,
and then and having formed for the committee,
mm-hmm, and
not getting approved.
Yes, some of your problems with John L. Lewis we mentioned.
So what I did then was go up to the secretary's office. And to
Secretary
Krug,
okay.
Secretary of Interior.
Mm-hmm.
And he gave me a job as a consultant to the secretary. And we began at about this time, General Marshall, Secretary Marshall, had announced the Marshall Plan for Europe. And so Mr. Krug asked me to be the chairman of the Interdepartmental Committee, which would study the availability of resources to see whether we were strong enough in the forces to put on a program such as the Marshall Plan. And we had members from the State
now,
Department.
Excuse me, I want to be clear on this. This was before you received your confirmation as director of the Bureau.
Before I went down to go to work in the Bureau itself.
Oh, I see.
They had this job to do, and he wanted me to do it.
Oh, I see.
Remember, the Krug had asked me to come because he was concerned with the fact that the government's material policies weren't very sound. We got caught in a war without a stockpile, so that we had difficulty finding and spending a lot of energy and resources and ships and so forth bringing our raw materials into to get the raw materials for the war effort. And so he was most anxious, as once head of the agency was the War Production Board. He was concerned about that, and he wanted somebody to work on that, and I worked on it with him during the time he was over there during the war.
But now this is post-war, and he was thinking that we didn't want to get caught in that same spot again. This was before the Korean War, but he...
This was before the Korean War.
Could you see it coming?
See the Korean War coming? No.
Not yet.
Not yet.
So
They formed a series of interdepartmental committees to work on this, and I was given the chairmanship of the Interdepartmental Committee on Resources. And I had a man who was on the secretary's staff, Arthur Goldsmith. And he did most of the work, but I was still working with the secretary on the Bureau's problems. But so we studied and wrote a report on the availability of raw materials, whether we could withstand a big program in rehabilitating Europe, for example, for the Marshall Plan.
Mm-hmm. Now, did this include things like food and fibers, or
no, primarily
only minerals?
It was minerals. No, it was resources. So I would. I think we did have it. But I didn't have any much to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I was watching what the Bureau was doing, and I was very friendly with the director of the Bureau of Mines. He was a doctor, by the way.
Hmm.
He'd been brought in there because of the safety program, and he was a great friend of John L. Lewis's.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And because he was working with John L. Lewis, who had been not very friendly with President Truman,
mm-hmm.
he wasn't very, and he stayed, and so I took John L. Lewis aside, so they mm-hmm. felt they had to pass him over.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Sir Sears.
Mm-hmm.
Very nice man. And so I got to know him quite well.
I think I'm just...
Now, one of the committees working on this was in the Commerce Department to see how we would take it from the industrial point of view and what kind of program it should be. And one day I was sitting there at lunch. Across the table from me was George Meany. You'll remember George as the head of the CIA FFL.
Mm-hmm.
And George told me then that Lewis had a man working full time to see that I didn't get appointed. And about that time,
mm-hmm.
After all the studies, and they had one man working full time, they came up with the fact that I was not legally a citizen, in their opinion. That my father had, I was past 21. No, I hadn't reached the age of 21. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I was past 21 when he became a citizen. Therefore, I wasn't legally a citizen. He had a big show and brought all the press in and made this great thing. So the press came over to see me. And fortunately, I had my father's naturalization certificate on my desk, and I didn't say a word, I just handed over them. What had happened that somehow in the transmission to the Congress, the wrong date of my birth was on that thing. Dad was naturalized and finished naturalization before I became 21,
yeah.
And so I was a citizen. So these headlines came out, and down the bottom all the press people pointed out that the right date was wrong and that I was perfectly legal.
Mm.
I learned from that the important thing to do was keep my mouth shut, not to get into an argument with Lewis in public.
Mm-hmm.
And the press were all really on my side. They weren't very happy with Mr. Lewis in having strife.
Mm-hmm.
Then as we went along, they had a nationwide strike. And they had just passed a law, two congressmen's names to it, Taft-Hartley Act.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they'd struck the coal mines, and we had in the bureau, by this time, the president had given me an interim appointment. I better tell you about that first. Get it in order. President said to me one day sent word to me that he wanted me to go over to the Atomic Energy Commission and take charge of the raw materials program, Atomic Energy Commission. And he called me over to
me. At the same time that you were directing the Bureau?
No, I hadn't taken the directorship yet.
I see.
I was doing this other thing. And so I went over to the White House and had about an hour with him, half an hour, I guess. And we started off talking about, everybody seemed to think the president wanted the president to fight a preventive war with Russia, to go to war with him. And I said, well, I don't think wars ever solve problems like this. And that's the kind of question we talked about. And then he said he would like me to do this thing, and they told me, didn't you? I said, well, Cap's out of town. And he brought me here, and don't you think he should... I wouldn't want to back out without him knowing it.
Now this is you talking to President Truman.
Yeah, Truman, yeah. So he said that was fair enough, and Cap was back in two or three days, a couple of days, and I went over to see him and told him what the situation was, and he trotted right over to the White House, and he pointed out to the president how important it was, and the president said, all right, we'll give Boyd the choice. Either he goes into the Atomic Energy Commission as a contender of raw materials, or he sticks to the fight. In other words, he was willing to go on the battle. So I called, I thought, they gave me 24 hours to make up my mind. So I called Ruth on the phone, and I said, this is the situation. Well, she said, Jimmy, I didn't want you to back out on a fight. I said, that's all I want to hear, because after all, this may be quite a battle. So I immediately sent word back to the White House that I would continue on the take an interim appointment. So they gave me an interim appointment, and I then went down to the Bureau to go to work. We hadn't yet finished this report, but I did both things from there on to the department.
That was when the article appeared in Collier's.
No. It was 2 years, with well over a year before that happened.
Okay.
Because he had to give me 4 interim appointments every time the Congress would go out of session, and hadn't acted. Then he couldn't. They couldn't give me. They hadn't approved me, so he couldn't give me the appointment. So he had to give me another interim appointment. I don't know where they are. They must be upstairs somewhere in the attic. Because you go the whole length of that thing, these big appointment sheets with Truman's signature on. So. But at that time, there wasn't an assistant secretary for materials affairs, or for mining, or resources, or what
it
might be.
This is in the interior department.
Interior.
Mm-hmm.
And Cap wanted me to be, as such, to be doing interdepartmental work as where it was rising. The first thing that came along was the fact that the Russians cut off selling us manganese from down through the Black Sea. And it needs 14 pounds of manganese to make a ton of steel, if you know, that. And we didn't have much production here, except from very meager sources. There was some in the stockpile. And so the steel industry was in real trouble. So we set up an interdepartmental committee to solve that problem, and I was chairman of that. And I did something that no one ever does in Washington. I ran meetings by Robert's Rules of Order. I insisted that people, when they talked to a subject, and the subject would be presented as a motion, and so we could get answers. That was very unusual. You just had bull sessions, and somehow it took a long time to come to a conclusion.
Hmm.
Well, what we did was to make arrangements for in Africa, and in Brazil for the opening of those mines, and we had to provide railroad trains and equipment and things like that. And I had State Department people on my committee, Commerce Department people, and so on. So we worked out the program to get manganese flowing in. And I had an advisory committee from industry on my behind me that I could talk to be sure we were going in the right direction.
And this was something new, to have this kind of setup?
Well, no, this happened, of course. Interdepartmental committees were set up, mm-hmm. where each department had to do something. Go to a political or a diplomatic discussion, or have to go to do something, like the Commerce Department about the railroad equipment,
mm-hmm.
and so on. There are hundreds of things that had to be done.
Yeah.
Just between the, and I would just listen to the discussion, have a motion, and then point out what each of the departments had to do. And they did what they were supposed to do, and we got it turned around, and the manganese began to flow. So that problem was solved. But this was the kind of thing that they wanted me to do. So besides running the Bureau of Mines, I was a sort of the secretarial level, being an assistant secretary, because there wasn't an assistant secretary, mm-hmm. as there was later on. That, in the Hoover Commission came along, at that time to talk about the organization of the government. And they set up then in the departments, at his recommendation, a series of assistant secretaries who had charge of these various things. And one of them was assistant secretary for minerals. And the but that was after Cap Kruger had left. Oscar Chapman became the secretary, and he asked me to take that job. Well, I'm a Republican, and it was a Democratic administration, and I thought that was the wrong thing for me to do, and I asked him if he would leave me running the Bureau, stay in the Bureau of Mines.
So this was a person who was put in between the director of the Bureau and the secretary.
Yes, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Or helped the secretary in the various... there are all things like the Reclamation Bureau and the Indian Affairs and things
mm-hmm.
like that. And neither the Bureau chiefs were did all these things, but they needed to get up to secretarial level.
Mm-hmm.
I never quite understood why Mr. Truman did that, but it just gave another... that gave us problems later on.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe I should have taken that job. I don't know. I would rather pay full attention to what I had to do in the Bureau and get reorganized. I went around, and I suppose I'm the first director of the Bureau of Mines that went around to 125 stations that we had. Safety stations and back in the hills of West Virginia or up in Alaska. And the result is I met some very interesting people. And I began to realize then that we needed a different kind of organization in the Bureau, and I worked up the organization, went for the Bureau of the Budget, and the Secretary approved it, and we formed a series of regional assistant directors. And there's a picture of those people on that on the wall, and we set up in various parts of the country.
And this was a new...
This is a new structure of organization. And
mm-hmm.
We had these people dealing then with the industry out in the field. One of these men who was the name was Elmer Pearson, and he had been director of economics, or the head of the economics division, as an economist, although he's a mining engineer. And but I made him head of the region, which would have been foreign affairs. And we had people in the embassies where the most important areas where materials were. And the State Department didn't like these people. But we needed to have some very good people back there. But only had five of them to cover the world. But nevertheless, I got Elmer in charge of that, and he was so angry with it. He wouldn't even talk to me. And we went up to a meeting at the University of Michigan, and he wouldn't even come the day I was there. He went the different day I was there.
Elmer
Pearson.
Pearson.
Yeah.
Was
later on, we became close friends. but he was so angry.
I'd better clarify that just a little. Why was he so angry?
Because I'd taken his job away from him as head of economics and put him into a different job.
I see.
And I eliminated his job, really.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing I did was to take the great scientists, like the metallurgists we had aboard, who had done wonderful things, and he used to go home with a briefcase this loaded, this full every night, and work all night, the way I did. and he was just so upset that I took his job as head of of a branch of the Bureau and put him in as the title we gave him, the chief mining engineer. Took away all the administrative work. He was a lousy administrator. And he was very unhappy, but in 6 months he came back, he said, "Jim, I realize what you did for me."
Good.
Because then He could talk all day and do the things that were necessary to get the metallurgical work going here and there. And he didn't have the administrative problems that a branch chief would have.
What was his name? Do you remember?
His name. I've got them all down here. Funny, it didn't come very quickly because these three, of course, eventually became close friends of mine. These are the regional directors. Mm-hmm. I'm talking now about the chief scientist. Mm-hmm. I can't remember his name. I'll remember it in a minute.
He
doesn't live anymore now, anyway. Mm-hmm. Then I took the chief fuels. He had the fuels branch, and they were running the bureau from Washington, and they really didn't know what was going out in the field. So I wanted the regional directors so they could deal with the industry, deal with the public out in the field, and be closer to the actual things that happen rather than having some branch chief up in Washington running. But people don't like to have these powers taken away from them.
No.
This fuels engineer was a elder. He was getting on for 70. And I did that to him, too. And he wasn't quite as upset about it, but he came to me and told me how pleased he was after he'd worked with it a while. It was a fine job. Now, to do that, I had to go and get approval from the Civil Service Commission, because there's a tendency to give a man responsibilities and his salary depends upon how many people he had working for him. Well, this way he didn't have anyone except a secretary for me working for him. He was free to come and go as pleased and get in work where he wanted to. And so the director of the Geological Survey and I worked with the Civil Service Commission, and we established these senior positions where we would have top scientists who could be doing scientific work and weren't stuck with administration, which most of them were pretty lousy about with. So these regional directors were, for instance, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. There were eight regions, including, that's right. Region nine was Pearson that I was telling you about. That
so
was the organization.
This is broadening far beyond just doing the safety thing then, wasn't it? You were getting into...
Yeah, I had the bureau to run. The safety was a very large part of it.
You were also broadening the scope of the bureau's
activities. That's right. But nevertheless, our biggest branch was the safety branch. Mm-hmm. And that then was run by this man I told you was my father-in-law's classmate at East High mm-hmm. School in Denver for that. And Dan Harrington.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we're always coming back to where I was talking to you before.
Okay.
Then we went into this safety thing when I wanted there to, I guess it was my scientific training that made me do these things, to show the importance of science and how you went about administrating the science things and not wasting the time of the great scientists in the detailed administration of manpower and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it really amounted to. And the secretary approved it. It's changed four or five times since then. But now, one of these things was that, let's go back to safety. I think I mentioned this thing. I told you about the roof bolt.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was an outcome of that. Now, I don't know how many lives that saved, because today, you, in a coal mine, you don't find these wooden props all over the place. You see these things bolted up. Mm-hmm. And one of my associates developed a new roof bolt that it was easy to drive and stay and easier to in place, and more persistent. It stayed right where it was. It expand. You forced it into a hole so that it, the pressure against the walls of the hole was such that it, you couldn't pull it out.
Oh, this is, was this an adaptation from hard rock mining of the rock bolts?
No, the rock bolts really came out of the coal mine. Later on, we got it, people began to use it in rock mining too, but the coal mines all had to be propped up by wooden props. Mm-hmm. And to be able to hold that back up. These rock bolts were used in the tri-state district.
Mm-hmm.
Because remember, they had enormously high slopes, so if you knew that, mm-hmm. they were very enormously high. And they had to be able to watch in the back all the time to sure there wasn't loose rock that fell on people's head. And so they put rope bolts into the bolts into the roof, and the whole catwalks up so that people could go over, up, get up there and climb up, break off loose rock.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't done to support the back. It's done mm-hmm. just to have access to back.
I remember hearing of rock bolts in the right after the war in.
Well, this is what I'm talking about is right after the war.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Just two years after the war.
In hard rock mining, it was.
Yeah, but it came out of.
In use, I
the rock bolt came out of this work. Now the point of the matter is what I told them to do was to get geologists and rock mechanics people and engineers and set up for a close study of it. And out of that evolved this concept of strengthening the rock by bolting it together.
Right.
That wasn't what had happened before.
No.
The other thing was just a means of getting, having access to the roof up high.
Now did you do any research through universities?
Oh yeah. We didn't do as much as we should. There was an opposition to the Bureau to let contracts out of universities. And that was a battle I had. One of these particulars, Zinner, was opposed to having any Bureau money going out to the universities. And I had a battle with him in order to get that across. And
so you set up your own program within the Bureau.
It was all done. We had research bureaus all over for different
mm-hmm.
parts.
Mm-hmm.
And we had too many of them. And an example was in Utah, we had a research station on the campus of the University of Utah run by a fellow Zimley. He managed that. And they were doing everything. They're doing physical metallurgical work. Well, Salt Lake City was the center of the mining industry. And what I wanted them to do, research on mining methods and recovery of metals and things like that. And there were no big metallurgical industry there that could have come east of that. So I wanted to concentrate that metallurgical work in College Park, Maryland, close to the steel industry and others where they could be closer together. And we could have concentrate on our physical metallurgists there. Well, Zimley took this to the enormous political structure of Utah. I think there were one congressman and two senators. And I got called on the Hill and dressed down very firmly because I knew where this has come from. And I said to them, I said, well, look, you put me in here to improve the operation of this thing. Why do I scatter it around? What I want to do is to make Salt Lake City the center of the hydrometallurgical field. This will do all our major work. It applies to what you do in Utah. And why should you be mixing it up with something which doesn't apply? Well, Zimile was very much upset about that, of course. But we did. We moved and we concentrated our physical metallurgic work in the University of Maryland on the campus where we had a station. And we then built up the laboratories and right next door to Kennicott's operations. And finally, Zimile began to see the light. He gave in and didn't play political tricks behind my back, left the Bureau of Mines and went to work for, after I left, went to work for Kennicott. He became a research director there. So I turned that guy into a friend. So
I'm reminded of the story that Truman said about Eisenhower, that when he gets to Washington, he'll find out how hard it is to get things done. It's not like the Army where you say do it and they do it.
Exactly.
You ran into this too.
Yeah, I told you the story about Scott Lucas.
I'm not sure that you did.
Well, I went up to see him one time and he said that he was, his industry, coal industry, was having trouble with coal mine inspectors. And I told him, yes, and your state's the worst state in the Union.
No, you had not told this.
Oh, I didn't tell you?
No.
He was reading a newspaper. And he put it down and he told me this story. And I said, and as long as I'm here, director of the Bureau of Mines, I'm going to have to put my best inspectors in there because they were doing all kinds of things that the Bureau had clearly said you must not do. You didn't, for instance, haul on your trains on the out by air, the air coming out of the mine. That's a coal mine expression, out by air and in by air. Because the methane was coming out in there with the explosive mixtures in there. You had sparks on the trains or whatever it may be. That you'd, this, but in Illinois, they were hauling on the out by air. And that kind of thing they were doing. And then they had... The coal mines in Illinois.
Okay. Scott Lucas was...
Senator.
All right. From Illinois.
From Illinois.
All right.
Well, he looked at me, saw the glint in my eye, and he picked up his newspaper. I never heard any more from him. Then later on, a fellow by the name of, very famous name, ran for president. He was governor-elect of Illinois.
Percy?
Oh, you know as well as I do. his son is a
Stevenson?
Senator. Stevenson. Adlai Stevenson. He came to see me. He went to see the secretary. The secretary sent him down to see me. And he said the worst state problem he had in Illinois was mine safety. I said, yes, sir, you've got the worst state in the Union. He said, what do I do about it? I said, well, you do three things. Number one, you take your director of safety out of politics, and I will give you the list of people that could do the job in Illinois that you can choose from. I won't tell you who to do it, but I'll say that these people would be qualified, and I'll give you a blacklist. Those under no circumstance you should do it. Second, you've got to rewrite your state law. Your state law is archaic and old. If you like, we'll rewrite your state law for you. Then you'll take your inspection service out of politics. Have them pass examinations that would come in there to have your inspectors be that way. Because up to this time, I'm still... This inspection was done by the states. They only want to have authority to enforce rules. And so each state had to have its own safety rules, and they were based largely on the recommendations of the Bureau of Mines.
Mm-hmm.
So he said thank you, and they went off.
Oh dear. Almost ready. Let's... Okay.
And he never put, the first thing he did, he's a chief inspector, died, and he appointed the man on the blacklist.
Oh, no.
Second, as far as I know, he never put the, either the two other suggestions that we had prepared for him up to the legislature.
Hmm.
In other words, his coal people were too strong for him. Politically, he couldn't get away with those things.
Hmm.
Next time I saw Adlai Stevenson was in the, when he was in the United Nations, remember? He went there.
Mm-hmm.
And I rode up in the elevator with him in the walled up auditorium, and I got to see Herbert Hoover. And he had the grace to blush.
Really?
He recognized me.
Uh-huh.
And so I don't blame him. I think his politics were too great for him. He wasn't a great politician, you know. He's a very fine intellect.
Mm-hmm.
Though I didn't agree with the way things he did, but he was too good a man to be stand the politics that it required. So those were illustrations of the kind of problem.
Mm-hmm.
Another example was a congressman from eastern Pennsylvania in the Anthracite region called me up to his office. And he said that the trouble was that I had an office in his district, and none of the members of the office were Democrats. Well, I said, Congressman, I'm not asked for the Democrats or anything. If you got some good Democrats up there that can pass the examination, we'd be happy to appoint them. And this went on, and about that time, a telephone call, and he kicked me out of his office when I answered this telephone call. I went back to Tom Miller was my deputy director, I guess. I said, I want to go home and bathe. I feel dirty. Oh, he said, Jim, there's so many sons of bitches in this country, they're entitled to representation in Congress. Well, he stayed there for years, and then he got into trouble years later. He really got into real trouble, and he got run out, I think. I don't know how it happened, when he had to resign or he didn't run again. Well, they're the kind of political problems you have.
Mm-hmm.
Then the next thing that I was concerned about was the fact that the Geological Survey and the Bureau of Mines needed to work very closely, because we were coming then up towards the Korean War, and it was very important that the geological people and the Bureau of Mines worked together. And when I got there, I'd say, well, now what is so-and-so in the Geological Survey? Think about this.
This was for locating materials.
Locating materials. Mm-hmm. Prospecting and doing geological field work.
Inventorying and stuff like that.
Yeah, things like that. Whether or not the metallurgical processes that are available to do recover those resources, all kinds of things like that. They would. So we put. We got two of our people, Julian Feiss. So I sent. He was my assistant. And a very interesting man in the Geological Survey. And they worked together, and they wrote up the agreement between us.
There really is overlapping there, naturally.
Yeah,
isn't
that's
there,
right. Yeah.
As you extended your...
You had to work together.
Mm-hmm.
If you were going to a district, it was just important to know the feasibility of mining a thing is to know whether it was there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a publication procedure by which we the Bureau and the Geological Survey would work together. Well, we bumped heads together. Bill Rather, who was the director of the Geological Survey, and they began to work. Then I got after, by this time, we had an assistant secretary. And we had him then have a meeting. Once a month, we'd have lunch together. The director of the Geological Survey and the Bureau of Land Management and the Bureau of Mines. And we would discuss the intervening problems. We didn't have any strict agenda, but we'd bring the assistant secretary up to date. Now I'd say, well, now what does John Soane say about this to the Bureau of Mines man? Oh, well, John says that, but he knows more about it than I do, and he'll do it. Then when the Korean War came along, this was all set up. And we had the law set up, government agencies to further the advancement of setting up mines or in the ranging for mines in the area. And the Geological Survey and the Bureau of Mines have to work together. And invariably, the head man was picked by the other bureau. There was man would always stand out in an area. One place would be a Bureau of Mines man, another place would be a Geological Survey man. We never had adjudicated. The men themselves recognized the need of having, and they would recognize who among themselves were the natural leader in that area. Mm-hmm. And that worked very well.
Did you have any conflict or lack of conflict that's significant with the state organizations? Were there state directors of mining or?
No, our association was very close.
Yeah.
We had our office in San Francisco, and we worked with the director there. And I don't remember. We didn't even have trouble with the state and, safety inspectors.
Mm-hmm.
There was a close relation. When it came up to the point. When we got these roof balls going, for instance, one of the biggest mining states is Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
And they came to me and they said, their chief, he said, I want the Bureau of Mines to approve anything I approve. I said, no, we're not an enforcement agency.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do the research work, we'll write the regulations, we'll come and teach you how to do these things and know what to do, but you are the responsibility. It isn't in the federal government, and I don't want it there.
Mm.
It shouldn't be there.
I think it is more now, isn't it?
Oh, well, since then it's become, particularly in safety.
Mm-hmm.
It's been taken out of the Bureau entirely. Safety things are now in the Labor Department.
Labor Department. Mm-hmm.
Tragic and costly, enormously costly. I'm still trying to. Of course, I was at loggerheads with John L. Lewis because they were fighting to get this done, and they were blaming the accident rates on us. But what they really wanted was to get the federal inspectors in so that they could maneuver them and use it as a bargaining tool in their labor negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
They never admit that, but that's really clear what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, they knew what I was doing. And they knew that they weren't going to get that law through as long as I was director of Bureau of Mines. It took them a number of years after I left, before I did get it through.
This might be a good place for you to mention something you told me off the tape, but I don't think we have it on the tape yet, about an accident where they didn't want to let your federal and your inspector in?
The only time that I ever had to enforce the law, or you take an enforcing action, is when a mine down in, I think it was in Texas, I'm not sure about that, had an accident, and our inspector went down to do what we normally did, go inspect the thing, and the mine manager refused to let him in. I called the attorney general, or not the district, the district attorney, I guess, was, and told him, and he went right in there and.
Federal marshal.
Federal marshal, whatever it was.
Perhaps.
You had to talk to the attorney, though.
Did I?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's all I had to do. They went ahead and did it. They knew that the law was. There's lights in there.
It's okay. It'll go down in just a minute.
So that's the only case where I had to exercise authority.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, mines would welcome your people in to study the thing for them, because knowing your people would know better than they would what happened and would have been able to write us an unbiased report.
Mm-hmm.
And those reports were vital. And you didn't want to have your inspectors be policemen.
No.
They were researchers, they were specialists, engineers and scientists, and they were doing it, they had no axe to grind except to get the job done right. As soon as you make them inspectors have a policing authority, you've changed the whole position.
The whole citation thing has come in since then. Mm-hmm.
So that's why I fought it.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as I was there, it never happened. And Lewis's boys knew that it wouldn't happen. But in the meantime, I worked very closely with their safety director, and his name was Ferguson, and he would be in my office every month or so having discussion about this, that, and the other, and if they had any problems with the safety questions, they would help me straighten them out.
Even at the time that John L. was still opposing you?
Yep.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, who was the fellow that was convicted of murder? He succeeded John L. Lewis as president. If you remember his case.
I don't remember.
It will occur to me in a while. Anyway, he was that in my day. He was the John's assistant.
Mm-hmm.
It was the top man, the heir apparent, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that funny? His name wasn't Kemp. But we were seen to be very close friends. In fact. In Minneapolis, we went to met in the airport, and we threw each other's arms around each other.
Well,
and all my people were just horrified to see me playing footsie with the mine workers.
Mm-hmm.
But I never allowed that to become a personal matter.
Mm-hmm.
Even no matter how many they were keeping me without salary and giving me trouble, it never became personal.
That's a real credit to you.
Yeah.
It was how many months then eventually?
It was 2 years from the time I was appointed until the time I was confirmed to the month.
And a great deal of that time you were serving without a salary.
That's right. About 18 months I served without. They had to pay me all at once. In the meantime, Mr. Truman had done what he had to do, and that was to lift all regulations on price control and things like that. So we had a little upsurge in inflation. But then it leveled up again. But to recover from the interference with the economic system that took place during the war. Mm-hmm. And you had to get those price control things lifted. And Truman had the courage to do that. So although I'm Republican,
Sounds as if you admired Truman.
I did admire him. I was admired.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's right.
Now, Roosevelt, you said you never met.
Never met. I never saw him.
No, but you did.
But I told you the story about when I first got to the office in the State Department building, which there was a note. The undersecretary came over my desk and said, "Dear Bob, do so and so, FDR," and I had to go and do it. Uh-huh. That was my first introduction to doing something for the White House.
Right. Uh-huh.
It was quite an experience for mm-hmm. him coming into the town.
Mm-hmm. But you saw Truman several times, I suppose.
Yes, because he used to come over quite regularly and have lunch with the secretary and his directors, keeping him up to date.
Mm-hmm.
And one example was I was sitting at the end of this table one time, and Secretary Kruger was leaving, and Chapman was coming on, and the secretary wanted each of us to tell what we had done for our bureau in the last year or so. And I was the last in line. And each one of them would, his great accomplishments were how much more money he got out of the Congress. And I got madder and madder.
Mm-hmm.
Finally got to me, and I said, "No, I've forgotten how to put it now, but I was proud of the fact that my budget was less, that we're doing more, that we had accomplished this, we had accomplished that." And probably everybody else would bet at me.
That's not the right bureaucratic thing to say, is it?
Well, I think the president approved it.
You were able to do this restructuring and still not expand your budget.
That's right.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Well, I realize now there were things I should have fought more for money. I had to fight for money.
Mm.
But I didn't fight for money unless I felt it was something was urgent needed to be done. Because remember that I was there to improve the raw material situation.
Mm-hmm.
So we were doing research in such things as titanium, of manganese, iron, steel, metallurgy. And the industry had pulled out from behind our cooperative agreement. And they were doing it on their own. They weren't doing it nearly as well as they'd done when the Bureau was doing it working with them and running the show.
Mm.
Because they could never get together on what kind of furnace they were going to do, and so forth. People in U.S. Steel later on admitted they'd been better off than Stamos.
Mm.
Now, during my time, I didn't initiate these things. This work was going on before I got there. So I'm not bragging about that I did this. But during my period, we brought titanium to the threshold of industrial development.
Hmm.
You know what titanium looks like?
No.
It's some of the first titanium that was produced by the Bureau of Mines.
I think most people don't have titanium in their desk drawers.
Uh-huh.
Now that's stronger. See how light it is?
Is this just titanium?
That's just pure titanium.
Oh my. It's heavy.
It's, but it's lighter than steel Uh-huh. It's stronger than steel per pound by a long way.
This is a letter opener that looks like stainless steel, actually.
Looks like, but it's titanium. It's lighter than steel. That was a piece of iron. That'd be heavier than that. Now, without that, we wouldn't have the jet engines that we have today.
No.
And there was a European who we bought into the Bureau of Mines that had invented the method of separating titanium. It comes very difficult. It's a common crust metal in the crust, Earth's crust. But it's very difficult to see. It comes as titanium oxide, TiO2.
Mm-hmm.
And to separate the oxygen from the titanium is a very difficult process. And you have to do it in a vacuum, and you have to do it at high temperatures. And you dissolve it in the salt.
Careful with these cords here. Yep. Now, was the steel industry...
There's what it looked like during the process.
Well, you
can see the titanium coming out of it. No, I'm all right.
I don't want you to check on that.
I've got to go to the red bridge.
Looks almost like a copper salt, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it is copper. It is salt.
All right.
And you dissolve it in there, and then you, in a vacuum, you let it precipitate up. Then you had to grind it up and separate and dissolve out the salt.
I see.
But you had to do. But titanium is corrosion resistant.
Mm-hmm.
And stands high temperatures and is lighter and stronger than steel for its weight and by quite a long way, the best steel. So today it's a bit, it's had its ups and downs. You're starting a new industry and it had a demand there and a change.
Mm-hmm.
And later on when I retired, I was working on a titanium committee for the Academy of Sciences. And my research director, when I was director with the Copper Range, was the chairman. And he wanted me on there. And we went around and visited all these plants when the industry was growing. So, then we finished up the work we'd done on manganese, to separate manganese up and do metallurgical stuff. That's essential to the concentrating of manganese from lower grade sources, and using pure manganese and things like that. Well, that was done in my day. And then the biggest thing we did, really interested to money, was to bring the making of oil and gas out of coal. We had a big agency, and we had large appropriations. This is the gasification of coal and the liquefaction of coal into petroleum. And we had two big research plants. But we had done this work, so we showed the science of it, that it could be done. We demonstrated that it could be done, and I thought that was as far as the government should go.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, those who were doing it in the Bureau weren't very happy about reducing the emphasis on it. I didn't think the government ought to be putting pilot plants in. They should be doing the,
mm-hmm.
I mean, these were big plants we had and were operating. We've been doing the research work, oil from shale in Colorado,
mm-hmm.
and we had big plants doing that. And it was up to industry then to take this technology and to develop the industry. that we shouldn't be doing. So I didn't put my strength behind these kind of things. I didn't think that was the thing for us to do. And I'm pretty firm in my convictions, you know, so I've got some enemies out of that, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Now, when the Korean War came along, and the president wanted to keep the control of running the effort in the government agencies, then they needed a minerals administrator, and they made me that. And that meant that I would have to approve building plants to get oil and coal from, I mean, oil, gas from coal if we needed them. And one of the first things that appeared was that we needed methane for something metal. There's a oil product we needed, and the oil refineries weren't able to produce enough of it. Forget what it was now.
All right.
Well,
Now the Korean War didn't I shouldn't say it.
I went into the Bureau.
Did it interrupt our materials policy as much, certainly not as much as the Second World War, but we weren't importing anything from Korea anyway, were we, in the way of...
No, not from Korea, I don't think. No, but we have the same...
How did this affect our materials?
The Korean War didn't have the kind of things we had in the other war. Not that we had submarines sinking our ships, bringing bauxite from Jamaica.
Our whole resource picture was interrupted there, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but we still didn't have enough copper, and we had to expand our copper industry, and so we were given the job as the Defense Minerals Administrator. I had to work with the industry and see where we needed to expand copper and give them the powers that the Congress authorized, like rapid depreciation, loans from the RSC, whatever is needed to bring a lower grade deposit into production. One of these was Copper Range, or the White Pine deposit, which was a large copper deposit. And I sent five engineers up to study this thing, and they came back, three of them contrary and two of them for it. But I overruled that committee and approved a program, not realizing that I'd have to go and prove I was right someday. It never occurred to me that I would ever have to fund management down there. And what we did then, we got approval. I've forgotten how this would happen to the Congress and the agencies. But we got them the rapid amortization question. We got them a loan from the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, and things like this, so that they were able then to raise the funds to expand that mine, put the smelter in and the mills and so forth, and make it into it. And they had quite a struggle, and the fellow by the name of LaCroix was the president at that time, I worked with him, and he bought it to us. And my copper people, except for this group that had disapproved it, agreed that we. I'll tell you, Jim. I told you, Lou Douglas. I talked with him.
in Germany.
His brother was Jim, and Jim Douglas came to Washington to be my assistant director of the Defense Minerals Administration.
Now, from Arizona, was he still
there? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Jim agreed that we ought to go ahead with that, so we did. And it was years later, after I'd been with the Connecticut for 10 years, before they came to me and said, well, you better come up and run it.
Now, this Defense Minerals Committee reported to...
Administration. It was a bureau, essentially.
A whole new
inside
bureau?
The Interior Department.
You reported then
to the Secretary of Interior
directly to.
But in the White House there was the Office of Production Management, or something like that, ODM and OPM and all. I can't keep track of. And that was run by Charlie Wilson. That was Engine Charlie. There were two Charlie Wilsons. One was General Electric, one was General Motors.
I remember that.
And this was Engine Charlie.
Oh, okay.
I had approved the expansion of copper deposits, including White Pine, things that the Connecticut could do to expand production. Made the approval to Charlie's office, but the contracts had to be let with the that agency that builds the buildings and takes care of the government facilities and so forth. It's a famous one.
Office of Budget?
No, not Budget Management. It was the
General Accounting?
No. That's funny. Well, let's go on.
I don't know. Yeah.
It was run by a man that I got very close to. This came about principally in the aluminum industry. One had to expand the aluminum industry again. In the White House was a fellow who's now a senator by the name of Stuart Symington. He was a resource director of some sort. And he'd been assistant secretary of war for air. And he wanted to quadruple the production of aluminum. And I said, Stu, I can't justify it. I mean, there's not enough demand that would justify the government getting into doubling it, until quadrupling it.
Mm.
I think it was but I could justify doubling it. And so I was working in this agency, because the other agency had to sign the contracts. They had the authority only to sign the contracts. And we would meet in that director's office with the aluminum people, let's take them, not the copper people. And in the very beginning, Jess, his first name is Jess. He's coming back. We agreed that we'd put some of these lawyers over my office so that as we developed these programs, lawyers could be working with it. So they wouldn't have to go through this mechanism, then go back to his office, and then the lawyers write the contracts then. They could begin to write the contracts from the very beginning. And he thought, Larson, Jess Larson.
Jess Larson.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then one day, Charlie Wilson called me up and he said, Jim, what's happened to these copper contracts? And I said, they've been over and Jeff Lawson's office. What's the name of that agency?
Well,
Services Administration. Public Services.
General
Services Administration.
General Services Administration.
That's right. We got it.
Okay.
And I said, Charlie, it's a damn shame. This has been over there, and these fellows were all in there from the beginning. They knew what the program was. All they had to do was write the darn contract and get it out. That's what we set it up to do.
Mm-hmm.
Well, unfortunately, Charlie used my words in talking to Jess Larson, and Jess got mad at me. And he was trying to get me fired. So it was getting to the time point, I think, that this way of my approaching, that I'd embarrassed the secretary a little bit. By this time, it was Chapman. Kruger gone. And he went off to Japan. While he was gone, the undersecretary called me and began to mumble these papers and so forth. And I said, what was his name? Dave something. I said, Dave, you're firing me. Well, if you want to call it that, I said, well, I've never been fired. I want to know what it's different.
Now, this is, you were still director of the Bureau of
Mines? Still director of the Bureau of Mines. I was still the Defense Minerals Administrator concurrently. Tom Miller did the running of the Bureau of Mines. We had offices right close together, so
mm-hmm.
we could, he could, if any doubts he had, he could walk across and we'd settle right there. When my predecessor was, one of my predecessors there, when Sayers was there, he had a deputy that had the door closed between them, and he would go directly to the secretary. He wouldn't talk with the director of the Bureau at all. But Tom and I had our doors wide open.
I think.